Selene Kurka, and I cordially welcome you to my podcast, Neue Musik Leben. I have studied classical singing and voice, and I love to sing lots of contemporary and experimental music. And if you would like to know more about me, please look at my website. And you can also subscribe there to my monthly newsletter. In this podcast, I talk about themes all around contemporary music and the human beings who are involved in this music scene. I share with you the behind the scenes, the insider knowledge, and most important, the human beings out of this world. I'm cooperating with NMZ, Neue Musik Zeitung, and yeah, I love receiving your letters, your messages, everything you tell me, and it's always also a pleasure for me when I meet you, when you come up to me and tell me, wow, I'm listening to your podcast. And those are very, very beautiful encounters for me. Also, this summer, we're gonna do the best of season again, because it's quite a success, actually, and it's a good way to kind of fill the summer for many reasons. And when I do the best of episodes, I look at all the download numbers, and then I decide from the episodes who rank really high to play them again. And yes, you like that, as I can see again in the downloads, and that is great. The best of episode today is very special because I have chosen it mainly actually because of a very sad reason. The episode I'm sharing with you is with the composer, curator, pianist, mentor, Michael Harrison. And I have known Michael for a few years now. I met him a few years ago in Bogliasco, Italy, with his wife Marina, and that was a beautiful encounter. And then we have been in touch, and then I visited New York and we met again. And then he also asked me to co-teach in his online Raga class. And so I have been also co-teaching with him and his beautiful team, and there are always so many great participants. Well, the sad part is that Michael has died in April. I was quite devastated because it is quite a deep connection, even though I have known him for a few years. But I think anybody who met Michael, he is such a deep, warm-hearted person and one of the most generous people I've ever met, and also one of the most talented people. So I feel very honored and privileged that I have met Michael, that we work together on many different ways and levels, that I got to meet some people out of his circle, and there's so many beautiful people who I am still in touch with. So in today's episode, I will replay an interview I've done with Michael a few years ago, and I want to share this interview with you today with Michael Harrison. Hello, Michael. Dear Michael Harrison, it's so great to meet you here.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to meet you too.
And just for the audience to know, we're meeting in Pelham, New York. I'm really excited to see you again because we met each other last year in Bogliasco in Italy. I guess this place we were, Bogliasco Foundation, is one of the most beautiful spots probably on the whole earth, or isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's the best place in the world for a composer. Uh-huh. Because the composer's studio is literally in the gardens, perched a couple hundred feet on a cliff over the Mediterranean. And there's nothing that you see except for the Mediterranean, the sky, and the rocks. And you have a little studio with a piano. And so it's really a composer's heaven.
Yeah, and there's this amazing garden, and it's really steep to the ocean. It's fantastic. So we are here now at a house on Pelham, and it could be that you will hear mowing the law. And so it's natural. So let's start. Dear Michael, how did you find your way into new and experimental music?
Well, my path in music has always been on the creative side. So even though when I first started playing, I was taking traditional classical piano lessons, my excitement came when my father gave me my first music theory lessons. My father was a mathematician, but he understood music theory. And then that gave me some of the tools that I could start to improvise and make up my own music. So that was the beginning, and that was in my really early teens, maybe 11, 12, 13. But I would say I really got indoctrinated into new music by Lamont Young. I was very fortunate that I met Lamont when I was 19 or 20 years old. I grew up in Eugene, Oregon, which is a kind of ectopian heaven in the Pacific Northwest of the United States. And I had the opportunity to come to New York City a few times, and I was able to meet with Lamont Young, and I told him how much I wanted to study with him. And the timing was perfect because he needed somebody to tune the piano for his major work, the Well-Tuned Piano. And he auditioned me, and I passed the audition, even though I was a self-taught tuner. And so I got sponsorship through the Dia Art Foundation, which were his patrons, to come to New York for many years. And, of course, I tuned the piano for the Well-Tuned Piano, but I sat next to him every time he played the piece and as he composed and developed it and for all the performances. And so it was like a real apprenticeship, you know, in a deep level that went on for many years. And so, and Lamont, of course, was a very highly developed, mature artist who had relationships with John Cage and Yoko Ono and many, many important figures in music and culture and art, too, Walter de Maria. And his wife, Marian Zazila, and his guru, who became my Indian music guru, Pandit Pranav, and of course Terry Riley, who was his best friend since high school or since the early years of college. And so I really kind of got introduced to this whole New York scene through the 1980s and 90s, and eventually moved to New York. So that was my, let's say, indoctrination into new music.
So it sounds like you already had very, very fine ears, because I mean it's all about tuning, and that you can really relate to it and know what it is about. That's a very impressive or a natural.
Well, it wasn't by chance, because what had happened was, starting a year or two before I met Lamont, I became very interested in Indian classical music, and I started studying with Lamont Young's guru, Pandit Pranav, and who I'd actually met before I met Lamont. And so I was singing for a year or two, playing the tambora, which is an Indian drone instrument that has a lot of harmonics, so it's the perfect instrument to sing with. And so that had trained me to sing in just intonation when I didn't even know what just intonation was. And so after about a year of singing every day, when I'd go to my main instrument, which was the piano started sounding out of tune. And so I had the piano tuner come and tune it, and it still sounded out of tune. So I started studying the physics of sound, and I realized that the piano is tuned in equal temperament, which is a compromise system where all the harmonies are specifically out of tune so that they can be equally spaced. And, of course, with Indian music, I was singing, you know, with incredible focus on intonation, and had developed my ear. And so that's what enabled me to tune the intervals in Lamont Young's Well-Tuned Piano without having any formal training.
And the teacher was in the U.S., or did you go to India?
No, it was in Pandit Pranav, was living in Berkeley, California. So I was going down, first year I was studying with one of his disciples, and then after that I started studying with him in Berkeley.
You also answered me a question, because when I talk to singers on my podcast, I often ask them about the microtones, because for many singers that's very difficult. And I also have the feeling that people who are familiar somehow with Indian music or even Greek or some other little bit more exotic music, they have it so much easier. And I also worked with Amelia Cooney for a short time. And yeah, I don't know if I could dig deeper, because I also found that it really opens up this world or what's happening in the space in between. But I mean, if you are so trained in a European Western way, it's so hard at first to leave what seems so familiar to myself.
Well, you know, people come at this, I mean, there's so much we could talk about in this subject, but the tragedy is that in Western music, equal temperament, which is how a piano is tuned, became like the law for music for Western culture, and then was exported to all of the, you know, European colonies around the world. And it's just one approach, but it's an approach that creates, every different tuning approach creates a new paradigm in music. So equal temperament created music where resonance didn't matter as much for the most part, and it was about the ideas of the music unfolding relatively quickly in time. Because if you have ideas that are unfolding slower, you want the harmonies to be more in tune than you're going to get in equal temperament. I know you do the music of Hildegard von Bingen, and you know it makes, of course you're going to sing Hildegard von Bingen in just intonation, because that's the natural way that we sing modal music. So I find that people come to alternate tunings through a few different pathways. One is through world music traditions, particularly Indian music. You mentioned Amelia Cooney, who I also know and love her work. Through electronics, because with electronics and computers, you know, you can just start back from the beginning, and you don't necessarily just dial up an equal temper tuning, right? And then the other way is through early music. Because equal temperament really started, well, temperament started coming in the Renaissance, but really didn't achieve fullness in equal temperament until, let's say, even the mid to late 1800s. So people that are doing early music, have developed the ear for it as well. And fortunately, there's quite a few of us that have been on these alternate pathways, that now there's a surge of interest in intonation and alternate tunings, and just intonation specifically, all over Western European and American countries.
And you mentioned your piano, that it seemed then out of tune. How is your piano tuned nowadays? Or do you change it every 2 days?
I change it a lot. But right now, I have two Steinway pianos, and one of them is in my Revelation tuning. I have a work called Revelation, which is probably my most well-known work. It's a 75-minute work in a microtonal version of just intonation that I invented. And then I have the other one in my Ragas tuning, which I designed to play ragas in the correct tuning on the piano. But I do change it a couple times every week, not the whole piano, but some notes, because I'm working on different projects in different keys, and so I have to change a few notes. And I also teach a group class, and the group class I find for men and women's voices that the keys of A and B flat work well, and the keys that I'm doing most of my music in are C and G, and so I have to always be changing a few notes in the tuning to accommodate the different things that I'm doing. But I've gotten to the point where I can do it relatively quickly.
And when you work with performers or you record your music, what do you appreciate most in performers?
Well, I've had the blessing to have worked with many great performers. And everyone comes with their different skill sets. So, for example, one of my best collaborations is with the vocal group Roomful of Teeth. And they're just one of the most amazing vocal groups in the world. Not only because of their musicianship, you know, when they auditioned for the position, one of the things they did is sight-read Bartok string quartets. So they have an incredible level of musicianship to pass an audition like that. But they get trained because every summer they do residencies with different experts in different world vocal traditions. So they know how to do Mongolian throat singing, Sardinian singing, all sorts of yodeling and all sorts of different techniques from around the world. And so when you compose for them, you can actually use all of these techniques. But the best thing about working with Roomful of Teeth was their genuine interest in my music, right? They contacted me, wanted a piece from me, and they really were supportive of the whole process. And it was also, their musicianship was really helpful because I could literally send them the new draft of the score 15 minutes before the rehearsal, and everyone would pull it up on their iPads and sing it. And this isn't just intonation. So they also, you know, we did a little bit of work on the tuning, but didn't need to do too much before they really embodied it fully and were able to sing in, you know, this microtonal tuning that I come up with. And then they really did a lot with it. Like, it was their idea to record it in the Tank. The Tank is Tank Center for the Sonic Arts in Rangeley, Colorado, is a like 80-foot tall ancient water tank, ancient by American standards, not by European standards, with a 40-second reverb that was saved and turned into a performance and recording venue. So it was the director of Roomful of Teeth that had the idea to record it in the Tank. So they came up with some funding, and we all went out and spent a week in the middle of nowhere in Colorado and recorded my piece, and they gave a performance and recorded some other music as well. So that's one example, but you know, everyone does something different. Like, I know you've also worked with my collaborator, Christina Vansu, and Christina and her partner, John also Bennett, bring a whole nother set of skills to the table, right? So they don't usually work with written music like Roomful of Teeth, but they're incredibly intuitive in their process of developing and recording and performing music. And I specifically wanted to work with Christina for these reasons, because Christina, it really was enticing to me to hear how she goes into a recording studio with musicians and basically listens to what they're doing and gives a few instructions, and then out come these beautiful recordings. And I wanted to explore recording improvisational music in the studio with Christina. And so the three of us teamed up and recorded an album in Berlin that I'm very, very happy with. And it's a completely different type of collaboration than something like with Roomful of Teeth or the chamber orchestra Alarm Will Sound, who I've also worked with. I'll say a little bit about my current collaboration, which is an ensemble of five musicians. Ina Philip, who is a vocalist from Brazil who studied with the Gundecha brothers in India for 7 years. So she's doing multi-track vocals with the Indian ragas. And so we come up with frameworks and then lay down one vocal line, and then she does all these incredible vocal harmonies in the studio, and she's really expert at that. And there's really no one else I've heard in the world is doing that exactly, that is creating these kind of harmonies in just intonation with the Indian ragas. And Elliot Cole, who is a composer, producer, multi-instrumentalist, vocalist, is also working with me intimately on the project. And Ina's husband, Benoit Roland, who's a French electroacoustic composer, and he does sampling of the works that we're doing, and then comes up with these amazing sound collages that become part of the fabric. And then we're working with three or four different tabla players, depending on which location we're developing our next stage of the project. So we're involved in really composing and creating the music together. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it comes from ideas that I establish, but then when we get together at a residency or in a recording studio, all these new ideas come, and we develop the music very spontaneously. And we've recorded 9 hours of music together already, just in the last year, which is part of a art installation in the Turchin Center for the Visual Arts. It's called Passage, and it's up through December of 2023 in six-channel audio. And all of the music is based on Indian ragas, and all the music is in just intonation and includes the just intonation piano. And one of the things that really interests me, I'm kind of diverging on your question, but we can, I think I'm answering your question at the same time. One of the things that really interests me is the intersection of Indian classical music with Western music. Because Indian classical music has so much to offer that Western music doesn't. For example, the raga system or raga science is the most comprehensive form of melody or system of melody in the world. We have, you know, a dozen different modes and scales that we work with in Western music, and in Indian music there are literally hundreds of ragas, including ragas that may use the same scale set but have a different set of melodic pathways within the same scale, so they sound completely different. Of course, it's all in just intonation, which is really attractive to me to have an ancient system of music to work with and develop. And the rhythmic system is also very complex and fascinating and satisfying. I love the intersection of composition and improvisation, where there are set compositions, but then, as in jazz, the performer develops an expertise in improvising along the set melodies. But what Indian music doesn't have is, I can't say harmony, because it, of course it has harmony, but it doesn't have harmony in the sense of how we use that word in Western music, which is harmonic changes or chord changes. Most of the harmony in Indian music is either a melodic note against a drone, which is creating a dyad, right? Or melodic outlines of harmonies. And there's some very complex harmonies that happen through the melodic outlines of the ragas, including bitonal relationships, where the melody emphasizes a certain chord, which may be very different than the chord produced by the drone. And I find that quite fascinating, because this concept of bitonality in the West has been around for about 100 years. But in Indian music, it's been deeply embedded in the music for at least 700 or 800 years. Mm. So I'm interested in these hybrid relationships where I'm bringing harmony and chord changes to the ragas, but not in a way that's done in like Bollywood music, where you just like sing an Indian melody and put chord changes to, where I'm actually taking the authentic shapes of the ragas and harmonizing them in dyads or triads. Mm-hmm. And with the multi-track vocals that Ina's doing, for example. Also some polyphony, you know, like having an ostinato in the piano that creates polyphony with the melodic structures that are happening with the right hand in the piano or with the vocals. Also with production techniques, you know, with computers and electroacoustics and all the sounds that we can create now with modern technology.
What I also found now very interesting, that you told me that you were singing the ragas for quite some years and you are composing for the human voice, which not all composers do. And since I'm a singer myself, I always curious how it is for you writing for voice, or is it easy because you sing yourself? Or, I mean, because some composers almost also tell me, oh, it's so difficult because it's so emotional and there's so many cliches about it. And I'm always sad when composers are so, yeah, hesitating towards writing for a voice, because as a singer, I love pieces. And so how is it for you writing for the human voice?
Oh, it's so great to write for the voice. And it comes very natural to me because I've been singing Indian ragas for 45 years. And it's a daily practice for me, so I sing 1 or 2 hours every day. And so my whole approach to music tends to be through the voice. You know, even when I play the piano or I'm composing at the computer, I'm thinking about the melodic line. And I'm trying to express it as a, almost like you would through the voice. So to work with the human voice is a luxury. Also, I view voice as the most living sound, and no sound is as flexible and as living as the human voice. So, yeah, it's just amazing to have the chance to work with singers like Ina Philip or Roomful of Teeth. And I'm singing in my own compositions some too, more now than I used to, and I've actually been singing on some of the recordings of the new projects I've been working on, so I'm excited about that.
Mm. And, well, since I'm now visiting New York, and you already mentioned great people who are also living and working here, how is the music scene in New York, or what can you tell us about for people who don't know anything about music scene here, or especially new and experimental music scene?
Well, New York City is certainly one of the cultural capitals of the world, and one of the economic cultures capitals of the world too. So it is really amazing to have lived in New York now for, you know, 35 years, and have been having grown with the music scene here and been parts of many different parts of the music scene here, from the, you know, minimalist downtown scene that Lamont Young was so much a part of to the more contemporary classical scene that's at Manhattan School of Music, where I teach and where I also studied with composer Reiko Fuding, mm-hmm. who I know that you're doing a podcast with tomorrow.
Yes.
So it really makes a big difference to be a part of a scene like this, because you can go to concerts any night of the week and experience so many different types of music on a very high level, and then go after the concert and hang out with the musicians. So you get to know really dozens of musicians, and of course the people who you're most interested in, you can develop more intimate relationships with and get to know their work even better. And so I've developed relationships with many different musicians over the decades here, whose work I've paid a lot of attention to and has influenced me, and probably vice versa as well. So I really don't think I'd want to live my life anywhere other than New York. But that said, the world has changed a lot, especially with the pandemic. And while as I used to go to concerts two or three nights a week, and my friends and colleagues would literally have like 40 concerts a week, you know, and I'd have to pick and choose which ones I really wanted to go to, now I might go to maybe a concert every month. And I think that's because I'm just spending more time. I want more time at home working on my own music. And I'm also listening to music a lot, you know, and everything's available online now. So one doesn't really need this scene, or I'm finding I don't need it maybe as much as I used to, but still it's really nice to have it accessible. And also to be able to support my colleagues when, you know, their piece is getting performed by the New York Philharmonic, or their opera is being performed by the Metropolitan Opera Company. Or whether it's just, you know, a downtown thing at the, you know, any one of the downtown music scenes.
But would you say that it's just you in particular that you're enjoying also time with yourself or in your music? Or would you say it's also for other people living in your city?
I think
city?
This has been a cultural shift. I think that the pandemic created a huge cultural shift, mm-hmm. where we're spending more time with online communities, and also listening more online than live. And I don't think we'll ever go back in the same way, which is kind of sad because I want to see live music supported. But we also need to find other ways to connect, and we're doing it through the internet. For example, I've been teaching Indian classical singing off and on for most of my career. And I taught for decades group classes in New York City. And now I shifted to doing it online. And it's actually much better because I have students from all over the world in the class. And it's convenient and it's cheaper for people, and they don't have to spend time traveling. And, you know, we have a group of about 30 students that gets together, and we've really formed an online community through these classes. And I also make a point of everyone getting to know each other and each other's music, and we get a chance to share our music.
So you found, obviously, a technical tool that makes it possible to hear all the voices?
Exactly.
Amazing.
Well, the way we do it is, well, I don't know if you want to hear the details of how we
because
do it.
I'm just, I mean, I also have been teaching online like vocal lessons, and some of my students kept taking those lessons online for mm-hmm. various reasons. It kind of works, just, you know, their voice and my voice, but I think if there would be more people singing, it would be my program would not transport
sure.
it. But so obviously there are options.
The way we do it is that everyone except for one person and myself are muted. So we do traditional call and response. So I sing a phrase, and then one of my co-facilitators and I, there's five of them in the class, so they take turns doing different classes. They sing back the response, and then the rest of the class sings back the response, but no one hears them. Mm. So they get support from the other person singing the response, but then they hear their own voice. And then about halfway through the class, the person doing the responses also mutes, so that people can just hear and experience their own voice. Then also during the week at another time, we have what we call a practice session, which is one of the co-facilitators teaches the class, but it's a smaller class. So people have the chance, if they want, to unmute mm-hmm. and have more mm-hmm. of a private lesson and hear their own voice and get feedback on it.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. And how is it here in New York? I mean, at least in Germany, there still is prejudice against new and contemporary music. How is it here, and what can you do to change it? Or are people here more open towards experimental music?
Well, New York is a separate category, because New York in general, I would feel, is one of the epicenters for contemporary music in the world, contemporary classical music and new music. So there seems to be a lot of interest and support for it here, much more than there are in many other parts of the country. But that said, there's also a lot less funding in the United States of America for music and for arts in general than you have in Europe or in Canada, which is sad, and that's where we stand, need room for improvement. You know, classical, most people these days only listen to popular music. And it's always a little bit of a surprise to me, because I know that about the general public, but I also do a lot of residencies, like we met at Bolyasco Foundation in Italy, where there are artists from different parts of the world and different disciplines, so visual artists, choreographers, painters, writers, etc. And it always surprises me that even in a community of artists, that most artists are primarily just listening to popular music and have, for the most part, there, of course, there are exceptions, but have very limited interest or experience in other forms of music, whether it be world music or classical music or contemporary classical music or jazz. And from my understanding, at least 15 years ago, classical music amounted to something like 3% of the music that people listen to, and I'm sure it's even less today. So contemporary classical music or new music is way less than 1%. And yet, of course, this is the field where innovation is happening. This is the field where music is developing. So it's really a sorry state for our culture that this kind of dichotomy exists. Now, there are reasons why it developed and exists, and we can get into those or not. And it has changed over the last century a lot. There have been periods where there was even less interest in new music than there is now, and periods where there is more. One of the things is that it is hard for an audience to accept atonality. Because if you look at a painting of contemporary art, even if you don't understand it or appreciate it, you can move on to the next painting in the gallery. And so you might only have a few seconds of interaction. But if you go to a concert of contemporary music, you're committed to sitting there in that chair for 1 or 2 hours and engaging with it. And so for people that find that disorienting, that's a difficult thing. And that's one of the reasons why there's been so much, I'll use your word, prejudice against new music. But new music has also broadened a lot, right? There's a period where most new music was experimental or atonal, and maybe was harder for a broader audience to appreciate. But now there is so many different types of new music that are also have a tonal center, or are based on or influenced by world music traditions, early music traditions, jazz, so many different things that our audience can find what they're interested in. And I think that, you know, there's all these little micro audiences developing for all these different types of contemporary music. And so many people like you are doing so much to educate audiences about the possibilities, what's available. So people don't have to feel like new music is just one particular genre. It's actually like a whole bunch of different countries, all with their different cultural tendencies.
Yeah, yeah. And you already told us that you're practicing ragas 2 hours a day, which I find amazing. That's so cool. I mean, I'm meditating, but that's without singing. And then I go to the piano and practice whatever is there to practice. And I'm always curious how you kind of, deal with your day. Is there any kind of time management, or how do you structure your day? Or is there a structure, or how do you do it? I mean, playing the piano, composing, singing, planning, organizing. You do a lot.
Right.
Teaching.
So, no, I do believe, at least for me, it's very important to have a routine. And one thing that I do every day is to sing Indian ragas every morning, because that's like my meditation, it's like my attunement, it's my warm-up, and it keeps me joyful and alive in the world of music. And I did that for first 30 years with the tambora, playing the tambora, sitting on the floor. And now I do it at the Just Intonation piano, because it incorporates more of my interest in music. I play the piano, I'm developing playing ragas on the piano, I'm exploring harmonies in the ragas and singing at the same time. Sometimes that's just developing traditional Indian classical repertoire and ragas, and other times I'm improvising and developing new ideas for new compositions. And that makes for a really great start of the day. And then the rest of the middle part of my day, the kind of 9 to 5 part of the day, is different every day, depending on what I need to work on. You know, if I have a commission, a deadline, I'm working on that. If I'm preparing for a recording session, I'm working on that, or for a performance. So it could be a couple hours at the piano, it could be a couple hours at the computer, just depending on what it is that's at the top of my list. And, of course, administering my career, handling emails, teaching students, teaching classes, you know, all of that. And then I try to take some time in the late afternoon every day to kind of come back to what I'd say is my core spiritual practice, which could be, you know, doing yoga and singing more ragas, you know, or going for a long walk, you know, just something to nourish myself after a day's work. And then my evenings, I just do whatever I'm inspired to. You know, it could be composing more, practicing more, listening to music, or chess. I also am an amateur chess player. And
oh, how so nice!
I find it really relaxing and invigorating, too, at the end of the day to play chess, and I feel like it keeps my mind sharp.
When you told us in the beginning that your dad is a...
My dad was a mathematician, creative mathematician, so he specialized in abstract algebra. And so he was constantly writing formulas and coming up with, you know, kind of creative mathematics. And my grandfather was a creative scientist. He was in the field of spectroscopy, which is the science of light.
Mm-hmm.
And he became the dean of science at MIT, where he was the dean... the acting dean and the dean emeritus for over 30 years. So I have this kind of math-science background, which, of course, infiltrates through my music, primarily through my interest in tuning and just intonation. But really, there's a beautiful quote by, I forget who it's by, but he was a German polymath from the Renaissance or the Baroque period, contemporary Bach, actually, that music is the arithmetic of the soul, unaware of its own act of counting.
That's nice, yeah.
And every aspect of music is a form of mathematics, right?
Yeah.
Because a melody is different tones in a scale, different numbers in a scale, but actually the frequencies of the melody form different whole number proportions.
Mm-hmm.
And rhythm, of course, is dividing everything in time, in a sequence of mathematical equations. And harmony, then it becomes even more complex, with different frequencies happening spontaneously or simultaneously. And then we have form and structure.
Mm.
And, you know, composers like Bartok and Debussy and Bach all used the golden ratio in their form and structures of their works.
I also find it interesting that I have the feeling with musicians or also singers, there are kind of two types. Either the ones who are not into mathematics at all, and they're usually also the ones that when you're studying, they don't like music theory at all. They try to skip it, and they're talented, whatever, singers, and they just do their thing, and they're maybe very intuitive, I don't know, but they really... That was horror for them to have a music theory class or a harmony class. And then there's this other type of musician who is really good at math, and music theory also is easy. And in Germany, when you do the final degree of the high school, which is called Abitur, there is a system where you can also pick subjects. And when I did this degree, this Abitur, I also picked for my main subjects music and math. And I also was good at physics back then. I wouldn't say no. And it was the combination that most people in my class had was math and music. And for me, music theory in a way also was always kind of easy. I also had Latin, which is very logical. And so... I'm not sure if I would like deal with it like all day long, because then I rather sing. And that was also when I had to make the decision what to study. Then I said, no, I want to do music, because I cannot imagine doing 8 hours a day math. But it still comes handy that there is some talent, or if you for a project have whatever financial plans, it's easy for me to deal with numbers. And so I've always found that interesting, because also when I studied then at Southern Methodist University, I was one of the singers who liked going to theory classes, and all the others were like, why do you like it? I have to skip it. Oh, it's so annoying.
Right. That's a fascinating dichotomy. It's true that there is a large group of musicians that are very fluent at mathematical things and a large group that aren't, and that really have done things more intuitively and by ear. And I suppose it has something to do with right brain, left brain too, processes and integrating those processes. So it's fascinating. Music is really a miniature of everything in the universe. And if we think of it, you know, there's no better training to become a human being than to practice music, because it engages our brain and our physical body in all of these different ways. You know, I'd like to share a story with you, because there's a very popular movie out right now, Oppenheimer, about, you know, the scientist that developed the nuclear bomb. And he, of course, knew Albert Einstein, and I believe became the director of the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton, which was, I believe, founded by Einstein or Einstein's associates. And apparently Einstein got together at one point with a bunch of people who were in the top fields, in the top of their fields in the world, right? So scientists, politicians, people of many different walks of life, but had all achieved extreme excellence in their field. And they all had dinner together one night to try to figure out if they had anything in common, because they were from different countries around the world, different languages, different backgrounds. And they found that they had all studied music.
Oh, really? Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing, yes. I mean, I also know this, you know, when you do music or you sing, you always use the right and the left brain, because some things are on the logic side, some in the more creative side, and that they're really well connected, which is sometimes hard for people to do, because they either switch, and it's always interesting. I mean, for us it's so natural, but I also think if you then reach a mastery in one thing, it seems sometimes so easy to put it on other areas as well, right? Because you kind of know how to get there, and then you apply it.
Exactly. And a lot of people that went to conservatories and universities and studied music, who found it difficult to make a living in music, went into other fields. I know so many people that were then successful in business or in finance or in so many different areas because music actually gave them fundamental trainings in life that they were able to use in other fields.
I can also tell a story. After I went back, after my bachelor and master's, Canada and US, and then I was also translating at fairs. I think you say fairs, like business fairs,
mm-hmm.
where companies conference come together. And it was back then a very well-paid job. So I did a few days of translating. I had all my money together and then I did music. So like I worked 3 days a month and I could pay my rent or whatever I needed to. And so I got to meet different companies, but I was not really interested in them because I wanted to be a singer. But oftentimes they offered me a job.
Wow.
Like in the marketing, whatever. And then I asked them, I'm like, why do you offer me this job? I have studied music. I'm a singer. And they're like, okay, we have been watching you. You can deal with people really well. And you're a musician, yes. You know how to really bring it to the point, or to, do you say it differently, I think?
No, that's good. To the point.
To the point. You can work under stress. And you know how to, whatever, build it up to have the result. And they say that whatever about marketing or whatever they wanted to have me, we can teach you that. But you have everything else we need. And I was like, oh. And it kind of, back then, it gave me relief because I always thought, okay, if I won't make it, I would probably be able to find a job. But I always declined because I'm like, no, I want to sing.
So. Oh, that's such a fabulous story. I'm so happy to hear that.
And I was also so relaxed because I was often talking to the CEOs, but since I didn't care, I was not even like, I don't know, humble or something. I was really like asking straight out. I'm like, why did you even get this idea?
Because you're so relaxed. You're not under, because you're not trying to sell yourself.
Yeah. So they told me. I'm like, oh, interesting. So, yeah, there's obviously big value in studying music. And, I mean, we love music. I mean, for us, it's such a big part of life. And I could not even live without music. But
I'm so happy to hear you say that. And I think that's very important for musicians and teachers to be aware of, to tell their students. Because, you know, a lot of people don't go into music because they're discouraged, because they won't be able to make a living. And this is a nice antidote to that, that musicians can be encouraged, people can be encouraged to study music because it develops skills that they can also use in other vocations in life. The other thing, the other side of this that's, I think, worth mentioning is how important it is for people who have other vocations than music to do music as amateurs. Because, you know, and I find probably most of the musicians in the world are, quote, amateur musicians, right? People that don't make their living doing it, but love music more than anything else. And they work another job, and they do music with their free time. And I think that is such an incredible thing, and I encourage people to do that all the time, because they can have a different approach to music than we can sometimes as professionals. Because as a professional musician, our livelihood is at stake, right? So it's very easy to develop this kind of love-hate relationship with your work because you also have to do it as a career. But if you're doing it purely as an amateur, you don't have that. And you can explore the type of music that you're the most interested in, which, of course, we as professional musicians ought to be doing anyway, right? And you can really develop an art without having the pressure of having to do it as a performer to make your living doing it. And in a way, it can be even more satisfying. So I just want to encourage all of your listeners out there that practice music, that don't do it as a profession, to really continue to do that and dive in even deeper.
I mean, since you're already having such a long career, I'm also very curious how do you, or what does it mean for you to be true to yourself or authentic in this world music business, and how do you do that?
Right. That is a challenge because there is always the temptation to, quote, sell out, right? To find a way to do something that will be more popular, more successful, or to make more money. But in the end, that may be satisfying to some people, but to me, whenever I've gone down that path, I've found that it wasn't satisfying. And so, the fundamental purpose of my music is for it to be my own spiritual path, to do music to bring happiness and joy into my life, to bring deeper sense of peace and understanding. And it does that because every day I'm singing, I'm singing ragas and I'm going deep inside the sound where it's like a meditation for me, right? So my musical path is my spiritual path, is my life path. And that kind of integration has been very satisfying. It has led to a very satisfying life for me. So I'm very happy with that. Did I answer your question?
Yes, you did. And I'm sure if you, since you bring it together, that you write out of your whatever heart and soul and you be happy, then I believe that it's also nice for the listeners. I mean, even if that's not your intent, but then there's a lot of power in the music.
Exactly. I feel that when I'm doing the music that I'm the most interested in, that it has much more likelihood to become some of my best music than when I'm doing music for someone other than myself. And I trust in the process that if I'm engaged with the music and I find it engaging, there's going to be some other segment of humanity that's going to resonate with the same thing that I'm resonating with. Mm. And that's proved to be true. And so I always also, besides encouraging myself on that path, I encourage my students or anyone that I'm mentoring to try to find whatever it is that they're the most interested in life and music or art and pursue that. Another way to look at this is when you go into your studio to create your art, do you focus on doing something to show something, to show a technique, or to discover something, to find something? And I think the second approach in the end is much more fulfilling because we're engaging with our work. It's a dialogue, right? It's not just doing it to show, and that's part of the problem with the whole jury system in education today, is that you're encouraged to present something in front of a jury that's going to serve you well. But that can be damaging to the dialogue that we need to develop with our own work, where we're listening to our work, where we're seeing what it has to tell us, and taking the cues from the work and continuing to develop in that way. And that's what creates a much more interesting life as an artist, and in the end, I believe, creates more interesting art.
Mm-hmm. And what does then success mean for you?
Well, for me, success is that I'm living a happy and joyful life in music. That is so much more meaningful than if I'm getting a lot of performances and a lot of commissions. Of course, I need to make a livelihood in it too, and that's sometimes the challenge. But if I stay focused on doing the music that I'm the most interested in, and I trust in the process, then usually I have some level of material success that follows as well.
And is there anything that drives you forward? Or what is your motivation or vision or whatever?
Well, I'm working on a very big project right now. Mm-hmm. It's a lifelong project that I've spent my whole life preparing to do. And I can't talk about it in detail, but it will start coming out as a series of albums gradually over the next 10 years. And it's based on Indian ragas and how they correspond to the different times of day. And what I love about it is that it's incorporating all the different things that I'm interested in. Just intonation, composition, improvisation, working with an ensemble, working with many different collaborators. Indian classical music combined with Western music, And so it's a big, ambitious project, and I'm already well underway. Your listeners having the opportunity to hear the recordings and to hear the compositions and improvisations that develop through this project.
Amazing, amazing. Yeah, I really enjoyed talking to you here in Pelham. And we arrived at the last question, and I would like to know from you, which tip would you like to give young artists?
Well, the key word in your question is young. Because young means that you're in the beginning stages of hopefully what will be a long life. And what can be more exciting than having a whole life in front of you, if your life is one of questioning and seeking? And so I would encourage any young artist to really pay a lot of attention to what they're the most interested in, because your life will be much more fulfilling and your work much more inspired if you're following your instincts about your interests. And I also would encourage people on the creative path, because one of the dichotomies, in particular in our culture, is that in the world of Western music, most musicians actually aren't creators in the normal sense of the word, that they're reproducing somebody else's music through notation, which I think, and you could talk a lot more about this than I could, has maybe a limiting amount of satisfaction, when I believe there could be so much more satisfaction when you as the performer are also the creator. In Indian classical music, there's no separation, right? The performer is the creator. And in jazz, the same thing. So we just have this dichotomy in Western classical music. And I think we're starting to bridge it much more, like the New School here in New York has a new program that they've opened up where you can get a master's degree as a composer-performer. Mm-hmm. And it's not genre-specific. It can be in any genre of music, whether it's pop music, jazz, or classical, or world music, or electronics. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting that they've came up with this idea, and it's attracting a lot of people. And as a culture, we need to do the same thing, right? We need to revamp our education programs to encourage performers to find their own voice as a creative artist, not just through interpretation of somebody else's music. And so my message to your young artists is, whatever field you're in, to find your own creative instincts and pursue them with all your heart.
Thank you very much, Michael Harrison, and it was so great talking to you today.
Thank you, Irene. It's been a real pleasure to spend this time with you in Pelham, New York.
This was the interview from today. I hope that it inspired you. And please send me your emails, send me your feedback, because I love to interact with you. Thank you very much that you tuned in with me today. I really, really hope that you liked it. And please tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. I thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.